In the 1980s, some of Kansas City's public housing units were infested with rats, mice, or cockroaches. Plumbing and electrical problems put the health and safety of residents at risk. Then in 1989, Julie Levin filed a lawsuit against the Housing Authority. Good morning. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we'll talk to Levin about the many battles she's fought on behalf of the underdog. Levin joins us for this look back on the occasion of her retirement from Legal Aid of Western Missouri. Then, as part of our Tell KCUR series, listeners tell us where they think smoking should still be allowed in Kansas City. That's next on Central Standard, after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today I'm joined by Julie Levin to look back on her decades-long career at Legal Aid of Western Missouri, also known as LAMO. In her time with that organization, Julie's claims to fame have included major strides to transform low-income housing in Kansas City and arguing an unemployment case before the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll hear more about that later in the hour. For now, it's my pleasure to say hello to Julie Levin. Hi, Julie. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Gina. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, can you start by explaining exactly what Legal Aid is for those who may not know?
Sure. Legal Aid of Western Missouri is a legal services organization that provides free legal assistance for low-income people.
And the cases that you've handled through that organization have really not been games of legal softball, not by a long shot. Do you think that you have kind of a natural fight in you, or is that something you've had to cultivate?
Well, I've always been sort of a perseverant person, and when I have seen things that I think are unjust and my clients are being treated badly, that just sort of causes me to dig in my heels and persevere and do whatever I can to resolve the situation, legally, of course.
Well, yeah, I like that caveat. What inspired you to go into law?
Well, I originally, when I was at the University of Wisconsin, I majored in sociology and criminology, and I thought that I would become a probation officer. So after I graduated, I applied for a probation officer job in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I was told that the job was between me and a man. And I went back for a second interview, and I called to find out if I'd gotten the job. And I was told by the employer that they decided that they just couldn't see a woman working with male probationers and parolees. And that, of course, was illegal at the time. We did have equal employment opportunity laws.
And what year are we talking about?
That would have been 1972.
Okay.
And I could have sued them, of course, but it just made me mad, and I decided to go into law. I figured that rather than trying to sue them and have a long lawsuit over that kind of injustice, that I would just go to law school and try to improve things for other people and to concentrate also on social work and the law.
So it sounds like the law is a way for you to channel like a sort of bigger sense of indignation.
It is, but really the law became for me a way to improve lives of low-income people in a way that I couldn't have done as a social worker.
Tell me about your own background. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. My father was a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and I grew up in Madison. I was born originally in Oberlin, Ohio, where my father taught. And I have been married for 44 years. I met my husband at the University of Wisconsin. I decided to go to law school, as I said, in 72, and worked for a year with my husband as house parents for a group home for delinquent girls. That was quite an experience, and delayed my decision to have children for a while after working with delinquent children. But after that position, my husband and I went to law school at the University of Kansas.
Okay. And so when you graduated from law school, you probably had a lot of options. Were you ever tempted to go maybe a more profitable route?
No, I went to law school to practice poverty law, and I was never tempted to go to a more profitable route. Money has never inspired me, although it's always nice to have. But I definitely wanted to do poverty law. I knew what I wanted to do when I went to law school, and I only applied for legal services positions when I got out of law school.
This particular issue of poverty law, what do you think it is that really drove you toward that issue, to wanting to deal with those things? Can you think of like formative experiences that might have really shaped your thinking about that?
Actually, I can. I had a couple of major experiences that got me interested in working for poor people. My father, as I said, was a Spanish professor, and when I was 8 years old, he taught in Mexico City for a summer, and we drove around Mexico City and the surrounding areas. And as a child, I saw a lot of poverty. I saw children living in dirt cabins, wearing no shoes and begging. And that was a very formative experience for me. I couldn't understand how there was such poverty in the world. I'd never seen anything like that. And then when I was a teenager, I volunteered at Head Start, working with low-income preschool children. And that was a very formative experience for me as well.
What kinds of things did you witness there that you carry with you today?
I witnessed a lot of children coming to school without breakfast, without proper clothing. I would make house visits with the Head Start teacher. She was kind enough to bring me along. And I saw a lot of children living in real poverty.
Well, so you carry those kinds of memories with you. And in 1977, you started working at Legal Aid of Western Missouri. What were the main issues that Kansas City's low-income residents struggled with at that time? And were they the same issues that they struggle with today?
Well, I started out in 1977 in a small neighborhood office on the south side of Kansas City. And I handled all sorts of types of cases, Social Security, food stamp, evictions, foreclosures. We handled a general poverty law practice in this neighborhood office. And after 2 years, I specialized in federal housing litigation. The legal aid program, Legal Aid of Western Missouri, had a unit at the time called the Housing Litigation Unit. And so I went into that unit, and essentially my cases consisted of federal class action litigations, litigation involving subsidized housing and other housing issues.
Well, let's talk about the history of public housing in general, if you don't mind, because it seems like we take it for granted maybe a little bit today that such a thing exists as public housing, but how did that come to be? Where did the concept originate?
Actually, public housing was created in the 40s when service people were coming back from the war and they needed to have affordable housing. So it started out in every city, every major city had public housing, and it was really for veterans.
In the Housing Act of 1949, there's some language that I kind of like. We had a national policy of, quote, a decent home and a suitable living environment for every American family. How do you interpret that language?
Well, and the language then graduated to safe, decent, and sanitary housing for low-income people. I interpret that language to mean that people are entitled to have affordable housing in a safe neighborhood that's completely habitable. It's critical not just for the adults who live in public housing, but for the children.
Describe what Kansas City's public housing units looked like when you first witnessed them.
Well, when I first witnessed public housing in 1977, the housing was in poor condition, but it wasn't completely uninhabitable. The housing authority at the time was run by a board of commissioners that was fairly political. And you would see the board members giving contracts to their cronies. So my practice in housing law involved several different class action lawsuits against the Housing Authority for various violations. One case was referred to as the rent rebate case, and that was a case that I filed in 1984 against the Housing Authority and HUD for failing to properly calculate the rent for public housing tenants. People who live in public housing pay 30% of their adjusted income for rent. That includes a utility allowance for each family.
Do you think there's a lot of misconception around that? Do you think it seems like maybe a lot of people think public housing is free housing?
Well, if someone's income is low enough, public housing can be free housing. But for example, if someone is making $900 a month, they would be paying $300 rent. We do have a lot of people in public housing who are paying $0 to $150 rent because there are a lot of very low-income people in public housing. But we also have people living in public housing who are paying much greater rent.
Well, so get back to, I'm sorry to have distracted you from explaining what public housing was like in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay, so as I was saying, the rent rebate case resulted in about $1 million paid out to public housing families who had overpaid their rent over a course of a four-year period. There were other violations that the Housing Authority made. They didn't provide proper notices to tenants when they terminated them or when they denied them housing. That was another lawsuit. They were providing improper grievance hearings for the residents.
What does that mean?
Residents who live in public housing are entitled to a hearing if they are denied or if they are terminated from public housing. And the hearing is, it's an informal hearing with an impartial hearing officer. But they do have a right to that hearing when they're being denied or terminated from public housing. And one of the lawsuits involved the Housing Authority's failure to do that. So each lawsuit that I filed resulted in a court order requiring the Housing Authority to repair and to remedy that issue that was the subject of the lawsuit. But the management and dysfunction of the Housing Authority continued. It sort of culminated in a lawsuit that I filed in 1989, which is the Tinsley case.
Well, we're going to talk about that in just a second. But for our listeners, I just want to say you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Legal Aid of Western Missouri's Julie Levin, who has worked for over three decades with that establishment, and she's on her way to retirement. So we're looking back on her career now. So you mentioned all of this housing, all of these housing issues within the public housing sphere came to a head with Tinsley versus Kemp in 1989. Tell me about that case.
Well, in 1988, actually, several tenants of a public housing development called Theronby Watkins came to my office to talk to me about poor conditions at the development. And I and my paralegal at the time went out to the development and we walked through every single unit, every single hallway of Theronby Watkins. And out of 288 units, we found that there were 120 units that were vacant, not boarded up. We were able to walk in. We saw rats, drug paraphernalia, Sterno cans, evidence of trespassers living at this development. My clients told me they couldn't let their children go out during the day to play. They were very fearful. The place was just terrible disarray.
Did you visit these places when you were working on these cases?
Oh, yes, yes.
So how did you feel when you were on site?
I felt terrible. I felt that something had to be done and had to be done fast. And I attempted for over a year to get the Housing Authority and HUD to fix these units up. And in 1989, January of 1989, I filed a class action lawsuit against the Housing Authority and HUD for uninhabitable conditions at Theronby Watkins.
So we're talking about a number of years. What's going on with the tenants as these legal proceedings are happening? Because in the law, years might be a short time, but in the life of a human being, it could be an eternity.
You're absolutely right, Gina. Well, a lot of people moved out, and there were more vacant units. But several of my clients stayed and decided to fight to get the development fixed up. And the Tinsley case involved not just fixing up Theronby Watkins, but also I claimed a theory of Title VIII violations, fair housing violations, that the uninhabitable conditions created a disparate effect on a minority population because Theron B. Watkins had about 99% minorities living at the development. And so these were horrible conditions imposed on minorities.
Wow, yeah. Can you explain Title VIII a little bit?
Well, Title VIII requires that people be treated equally in terms of their housing. And it prohibits organizations and landlords and homeowners, or home sellers, I should say, from treating people differently in the processes of renting or selling their home. The Tinsley case resulted in a consent decree, a court order.
What does that mean?
A consent decree is a settlement agreement that's entered and approved by the court. And so that was entered in 1991, and the order required that the Housing Authority totally renovate Theron B. Watkins and that it desegregate public housing in Kansas City.
Wow. So that was that's amazing that that was considered that was a segregation case that recently in our city.
That's correct. Well, as we had talked about the early beginnings of public housing, actually in Kansas City, there was racial steering for public housing. Public housing was definitely segregated in Kansas City early on, and it continued throughout the 70s. People who were minorities were steered to certain public housing developments. Non-minorities were steered to others.
So 1991, they enter a consent decree. The idea is that that would change things. What happened then?
Well, the Housing Authority was mandated under the consent decree to begin repairing Theron B. Watkins immediately. There were a lot of other things they were supposed to do under the consent decree, and after 6 months, they hadn't done anything. So I filed a motion to have the Housing Authority and HUD held in contempt of court for violating the consent decree. And we had a hearing in June of 1992. And at that time, Judge Whipple, who has been the judge on this case since 1989.
And still is today.
And still is today. And he's been fantastic. He's been extremely compassionate and concerned about the residents. In 1992, he held the Housing Authority and HUD in contempt of court and ordered them to start working on the consent decree, start complying within 6 months.
And so what happened then?
Well, 6 months came and went, and the Housing Authority still had not complied with any of the provisions of the consent decree. So I filed another motion to have the Housing Authority held in contempt of court. And in July of 1993, we had a hearing on that contempt motion. And at that time, I asked Judge Whipple to hold the Housing Authority in contempt for their violations and to appoint a receiver to manage the Housing Authority, since it was obvious that they weren't able to manage themselves.
Well, so you've mentioned Judge Whipple a couple of times. How important was his role in all of this? Can you imagine that if it had been someone else, things might have gone differently, or is that just speculation?
Oh, absolutely. His role has been critical. He has been very, as I said, very concerned about the residents, concerned that there not be any political interference with the Housing Authority, as there had been continuously during the lawsuit. And it could have easily gone a different way with a different judge.
So after filing two motions against the Housing Authority, and finally they're put into receivership in 1993, what does that mean?
Well, receiverships are typically used in bankruptcy cases where a company will go bankrupt and a receiver will be appointed to handle all the contracts and obligations of that company. A receivership had only been used once before regarding a housing authority, and that was in Boston, the Boston Housing Authority, and that had been about 9 years prior to the Tinsley case.
So the Housing Authority actually stayed in receivership for 20 years. What does that mean?
Well, that means that a receiver operated their contracts and their policies and procedures in the place of a board of commissioners to oversee the Housing Authority for that time period.
How did public housing in Kansas City change during those 20 years?
Public housing in Kansas City had a dramatic change in those 20 years. Every single unit of public housing, and there are approximately 1,900 units of public housing, was either completely renovated or demolished and replaced with a newly constructed unit. Because the Housing Authority was in receivership, we were able to get an order from Judge Whipple that any unit that was sold or demolished by the Housing Authority had to be replaced on a one-for-one basis, which means that Kansas City is the only city in the country that did not lose public housing in the last 15 years. Every other city has been demolishing or selling public housing, and under the law, they didn't have to replace it on a one-for-one basis.
Wow. So, okay. We have just as much public housing as we ever did, but you see, it sounds like you're saying that you've seen it transformed. What does public housing look like now? And do you know people who have lived in public housing throughout that entire time?
Yes, I do have some clients who have lived in public housing since 1989, since the lawsuit was filed.
How do you see their lives changed?
They're a lot happier. They're proud of where they live. They are engaged, volunteer to make their housing and their communities a lot safer and better. I see a huge difference in the lives of the children, where children grew up in totally dilapidated housing. Children tend to reflect their surroundings. And when you live in a community that's depressed and in conditions that are uninhabitable, you begin to see your life that way. You begin to feel that way about yourself. And so children living in really excellent housing that has good social services and a productive community reflect that. So I have seen a very big difference in the lives of my clients and their children.
What about your life over this course of time? I mean, it sounds like this would be a very all-consuming thing that you've been working on. How did that affect you as a human being?
Well, that's a good question. I've just been very passionate about it. It has been pretty all-consuming for me. I think it's just made me appreciate my surroundings, certainly has made me appreciate my clients and my coworkers. My clients are just a tremendous source of inspiration for me. They have been very supportive of getting the communities in better condition. I work with wonderful staff of attorneys, paralegals, and support staff who are dedicated to the same goals and mission of improving the lives of low-income people. So I guess it has, I don't know that it's changed me. It's reinforced my beliefs about improving lives through legal action, through lives of the low-income community through legal action.
Were there moments where you thought that it was just never going to change?
Gina, I never thought that I would see this kind of change in my lifetime. I really didn't. When I filed the lawsuit, the subject of the lawsuit really was Theron B. Watkins and desegregating public housing. But when the Housing Authority went in receivership, that really expanded the lawsuit tremendously because the receiver then was responsible for all public housing developments and all of the operations and contracts of the Housing Authority. So that expanded my role and my client's role tremendously.
I understand that you have become sort of an unofficial national consultant on public housing law, that you talk to people in other cities based on what has changed here in Kansas City. And when you talk to people in other cities about public housing, what do they typically ask you and how do they typically respond to the way this story played out here?
Well, I work with housing advocates across the country. I'm on the Advisory Council for the National Housing Law Project, which is a national organization that works in low-income housing litigation. And housing advocates across the country would like to reproduce what we've done here. And several legal aid attorneys have filed receivership cases since the Tinsley case. The Housing Authority in Kansas City has been used as a model housing authority, both by HUD and housing advocates, because we have this tremendous partnership with the Housing Authority. And when I say we, I mean the residents of public housing and my clients have a partnership with the Housing Authority. We have a voice in their policies and procedures and their contracts and their activities. And so this public housing population is very engaged with their Housing Authority. And there really isn't any other housing authority that has that kind of relationship with their tenants.
Julie, we have an unsolicited call from one of our listeners who wanted to call in and share some experiences he's had with you. So we're going to turn now to Larry in Kansas City. Hi, Larry.
Hi, and thank you, Julie, for the tremendous change that you brought to the Housing Authority. I was on staff from about 1989 and until around 1994. And I often wondered if things actually had to be as bad as I saw them at the time. And I applaud the noble steps that you took, the integrity that you exercised in doing the things that you did to bring the very positive and constructive changes to the Housing Authority in Kansas City.
Larry, do you specifically remember any steps that required a great deal of integrity in Julie's handling?
Our contracting department had just had a political appointee made, and our contracting department was assembled, and that political appointee made the announcement to our assembled staff that effective immediately we would no longer be answering to our appointed supervisors, but directly accountable to that political appointee, at which time I eased my chair back and stood up in the boardroom and said, and I have no further business with the Housing Authority. That, unbeknownst to me, there was legal action going on behind the scenes to address that kind of arm wrestling back and forth for control of the Housing Authority, primarily for its resources. And I, again, simply had a notion of we ought to be about doing the business of what our stated purpose is, to provide safe, sanitary, affordable, decent housing to people.
Okay, and I'd love to get Julie's response, and thank you so much, Larry, for calling. Julie, do you remember Larry's case?
I certainly do, and hi, Larry. It's wonderful for you to call. Yes, Larry was a very wonderful employee at the Housing Authority with high integrity, and there were employees who did have integrity and did contact me to give me information as well, because there was a lot of cronyism and illegal activity going on at the Housing Authority. And Judge Whipple recognized this, and from the bench he dispatched the FBI when the Housing Authority went in receivership to go and to...
Were criminal charges ever filed?
No, they were not ever filed. I don't know what happened to the investigation because that was confidential. But there were documents that were being hidden and erased from computers, and a lot of information came out from employees about what was going on at the time.
Yikes!
Yeah, but Larry's absolutely right. There were a lot of problems, which created this whole dysfunction at the Housing Authority and why they couldn't follow the law in any respect.
Well, we'll get current with Kansas City's public housing issues in a little while, but I want to talk about one of your other big cases having to do with employment law and mothers who take maternity leave. Tell us about the woman who brought that case into your life. What was her story?
My client was Linda Wimberly, and she came to my office because she had been working at JCPenney's, and she became pregnant. And about a couple, maybe 4 weeks before she was ready to give birth, she went to her employer and asked them if they would give her a leave of absence. They told her at the time, and this was in 1984, they told her that JCPenney's didn't have leaves of absence, but if they had a job available when she was ready to come back, she's a good worker, that she could call her supervisor, and if they had a job, she could take it. she could have it. So 3 weeks after giving birth, my client called her supervisor and said, I'm ready to come back to work. And her supervisor said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have a job for you. So my client applied for unemployment compensation. And she was denied unemployment compensation because
Why?
The state of Missouri denied her unemployment compensation because they said that she had voluntarily quit her job.
Because she went to have a baby.
That's correct.
Okay.
And so there was a federal statute that said that no person shall be denied unemployment compensation solely on the basis of pregnancy or termination of pregnancy. I appealed the unemployment compensation decision, claiming that that statute under the Supremacy Clause prevented them from denying unemployment compensation. And we won at the trial level. And the state of Missouri appealed to the Court of Appeals in Missouri. And we won at the Court of Appeals level. And then the state of Missouri appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court. And we argued the case in front of the Missouri Supreme Court. And the Missouri Supreme Court said that the state of Missouri was in the right to deny unemployment compensation because she quit without good cause attributable to her work or to her employer. And because the state of Missouri was treating people who leave because of a heart attack the same way. So in other words, anybody who leaves a job, whether it's due to illness or pregnancy, and comes back and there's no job available, is not entitled to unemployment comp. So after we lost in the Missouri Supreme Court, I filed a petition for review for certiorari with the United States Supreme Court. And that's basically just a brief that you file asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case, to take the appeal. And much to my shock and dismay, they granted the petition for cert, and we were going to argue the case in front of the United States Supreme Court.
That is so crazy. Was arguing a case in front of the Supreme Court a nerve-wracking experience?
That's putting it mildly. It was very nerve-wracking, very stressful, but a really exciting experience.
So what changed as a result of that case? Anything?
Yes, there was change. It took a little while. Unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court agreed with the state of Missouri that as long as they treated disabled people the same as they treated pregnant women, the state could deny unemployment compensation. But there was so much bad publicity with the state of Missouri. Oh, and keep in mind, there was no Family Leave Act. Employers at the time didn't have to give leaves of absence at all. So the state of Missouri was really shamed, though, by the national press after that decision came out. And the next year, the state of Missouri's legislature changed the law so that after that, women who left their job because of pregnancy and had no job to return to were given unemployment compensation.
Wow, that is an amazing accomplishment. We'll be back to this conversation with Julie Levin after a short break. You're listening to Central Standard, and we'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Julie Levin, who's worked as an attorney for Legal Aid of Western Missouri for the last more than 30 years, right, Julie?
Right, 37 years.
So she's leaving that post after holding on and fighting the good fight for a long time, and we're catching up with her on the accomplishments of her career and on the issues in Kansas City that she's witnessed. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to turn now to we've got a call from someone who wants to tell us a little perspective on one of the cases Julie was just talking about. We've got Aline in Overland Park. Hi, Aline.
Hello. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Aline. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Gina, I just called in to say that I was on the other side of Julie on the Tinsley case for 9 years. I represented HUD for the first 9 years. And I will tell you that she's not only a tireless opponent, she's a formidable one as well. And Legal Services is going to have a hard time filling her shoes. I'd like to say I have bad things to say, but I have nothing to say about Julie.
That's pretty amazing that someone's opponent would call in and say they have nothing but great things to say. What was the experience like for you?
Well, it was a long and difficult case, and somewhat typical of class action cases against the government. I was with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and this one in particular was difficult just because of how Julie has just explained it, how complicated it was. And, you know, we certainly didn't always get along. We had plenty of fights. But I will have to say that she is, as the profession says, a gentlewoman and a scholar, in addition to being a fine attorney. There were some times when it was a lot of fun. There were some times when it was really difficult, particularly, as she says, when the FBI was called in to check things.
Aline, did Julie change your mind over the years on this issue?
No. Honestly, no, not really. No, because we both had the same goal, you know, in mind, which was to get safe, secure housing for those who needed it. We disagreed on the ways to go about it from time to time.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aline.
And, you know, as you leave Legal Aid, Julie, after a really profound career there, how will your successors carry that torch, so to speak? What's the work that remains to be done today in terms of advocacy for the underrepresented?
Well, I have an amazing, talented staff, and the work will carry on just as it has been. The Tinsley case, even though the receivership ended on May 1, the receivership ended, but the case itself will continue for yet another year. And my successor, Jane Worley, who has been an attorney at Legal Aid and in our housing unit for 35 years, she will continue the case, and she'll do an excellent job. She's a wonderful attorney. So I have no qualms at all about how things will proceed.
Well, I want to get back to the public housing issue. Despite the well-known risks, rates of smoking have remained high in Missouri, about 25% of adults compared with 18% nationally. And in Kansas City, public housing, the problem is more acute, with a smoking rate of around 40%. That's especially disturbing to health advocates because of the high numbers of vulnerable people, children, the disabled, and elderly, who live in public housing. A new policy aims to do away with smoking in city-owned housing, and KCUR's Alex Smith takes us there.
On a breezy Friday afternoon at Gwinnett Manor, Carrie Terry lights up a cigarette and fumes over changes coming to her building.
I think it's BS.
Terry's talking about the upcoming ban on smoking, both inside and outside Housing Authority properties.
It's against our rights. We have the right to do what we, within reason, in our own homes, and it's against our legal rights as a U.S. citizen.
After a year and a half of planning and asking for comments, the Housing Authority made it official earlier this month. A smoking ban will go into effect on July 1st, affecting more than 5,000 people living in about 1,700 apartments and houses. People in the Housing Choice Voucher Program, or what used to be called Section 8 housing, won't be affected. Edwin Lowndes is executive director of the Housing Authority. He says the move was prompted by a fire at Brush Creek Towers 2 years ago.
It was a smoker who was smoking in bed, who also was on oxygen. He had respiratory issues. And somehow he lit his apartment caught on fire because of his smoking. And it caused a significant amount of damage to that high rise.
Lowndes says the ban is needed to protect resident health and safety, but it's also to protect the buildings from smoke damage. About a quarter of the residential units change tenants every year, and cleaning up after smokers can cost the Housing Authority a lot of money.
If it's a light smoker, it might add to our cost about $1,500 just to change it. But if it were a heavy smoker that lived in that apartment for a considerable time, it might be an additional or a total of $5,000 more than what we'd ordinarily term.
He estimates that banning smoking could save the Housing Authority as much as $500,000 a year. A Mid-America Regional Council survey shows that the majority of the residents support the ban, but Martha Allen, who's president of the Public Housing Residents Council, has heard from many people like Terry who oppose it.
Can you imagine someone who's on Social Security, Medicaid, or probably not getting any income at all, and they started smoking when they were very young, and now you're telling them you've got to quit? Where am I going to go? Smoking is my only pleasure, some of them said.
Allen supports the ban, but along with the Residents' Council, she pushed for a few accommodations to help smokers. One would connect people to low or no-cost stop smoking programs. Another offers a grace period for some smokers that would last until the end of the year. But for many residents, the issue isn't quitting smoking. It's about personal rights. In Kansas City, Missouri, public housing residents pay 30% of their income for rent. And as Allen explains, the idea of home is an emotional issue.
People figure when they got a home, no one should be able to go into the home and tell them what to do.
I can certainly understand why they feel that way. And it is their home. But it is property that belongs to someone else.
Alan Rostron teaches constitutional law at UMKC. He says not only is the Housing Authority a property owner, but it's also a government agency, which means it has that much more authority to implement a ban. As for smokers' rights, those who light up aren't really entitled to protection in the way, say, racial or religious groups are.
All the government needs to do to regulate smoking is show that the regulation in question is rational. It really just has to be something that is at least possible or arguable that it could serve a legitimate government interest of some sort.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development encouraged public housing authorities to ban smoking in 2009. To date, more than 600 have done so, and none have faced a successful legal challenge, according to the Smoke-Free Environments Law Project. A smoking ban came to Lawrence Douglas County in January of 2011. Executive Director Shannon Oury believes it's the first and only ban in Kansas. The policy decision also met with anger and some indifference from residents there, even after it was implemented.
We have had some people who it took a while to get them to respect the policy.
But Oury says the ban so far has not led to any evictions, and it's even caused some residents to quit smoking. When it comes to enforcement in Kansas City, Executive Director Lowndes insists the Housing Authority won't be intrusive.
We're not going to be, knocking on doors and going into apartments.
But the enforcement policy will have teeth. It'll be a three-strike system with two warnings and then the possibility of eviction. Those consequences could be severe for low-income residents, but that doesn't bother resident Renee Lewis. She's a ban supporter who's more concerned about the health of her children than the rights of her smoking neighbors.
Yes, I will report them. Yes. Because if I have to live by the rules, I feel that you would as well.
Smokers living in Housing Authority properties now have just over a month to decide how they're going to deal with the ban. Alex Smith, KCUR News.
Julie Levin, what's your legal perspective on this smoking ban in public housing as a longtime advocate for residents of public housing?
Well, Gina, the Public Housing Resident Council that was referenced there, Martha Allen is the president of that organization, and they are a plaintiff in the Tinsley case. So the Public Housing Resident Council did support the smoking ban, but they requested that there be an extension of time for people to comply with the no smoking. And they also requested substantial resources be made available for people to help them stop smoking. The Housing Authority at their board meeting last night expressed willingness to work with the Public Housing Resident Council and the residents to get as many resources as possible. They're arranging for services to be brought to the particular developments for six-week cessation classes. But they're also aware that the Housing Authority may have to revisit the smoking ban policy and make some modifications to it. So it really is it's going to be a trial and error situation. But essentially the tenants, the organization as a whole supports the smoking ban, but they want to make sure that people who have had hard time stopping smoking are given the right support that they need.
This idea of home being an emotional issue seems like one that would resonate with you after the work you've done.
Yes, it does. It is very emotional, and I understand the addiction. Smoking is a very strong addiction, and people feel that your home is your castle. You should be able to do whatever you want. Unfortunately, there are a lot of children in public housing, and there's also a high incidence of asthma and other respiratory problems among the children. And so the smoking has an effect on other people. So being able to do what you want in your own home isn't just affecting you, it's affecting all these other people who live around you.
Well, Julie Levin, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you today, and best of luck to you as you enter this new phase in your life and career.
Thank you so much, Gina.
Julie Levin has worked for Legal Aid of Western Missouri for the past 37 years. She spoke to us today on the occasion of her retirement. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? All right, it's time for Tell KCUR. The question we asked our listeners this week was, where should we still allow smoking in Kansas City? We asked that question in light of the smoking ban in public housing, which KCUR reported on just a moment ago. Here to share your answers is Allison Rawlitz.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me. First off, I would just like to say this question hit a chord in Kansas City. We got a really big response, more so on Facebook especially, and it really just ignited a lot of passion between smokers and non-smokers in general.
Well, how have people been answering the question we asked? Where do our listeners think smoking should still be allowed now that it's against the law to light up in restaurants and bars and soon in public housing, even on the porches?
Well, Gina, if you're a smoker in Kansas City, these answers were not very promising. We had a lot of people actually say nowhere, and that's all they would tweet or put on Facebook, just nowhere, nowhere, nowhere. In other words, like Matt tweeted, in 1950, you know, and Nancy tells us
that.
On Facebook, yeah, I know. Some people actually started pitting towns against each other, like saying it's only allowed in Raytown or it's only allowed in Kansas City, Kansas. But Nancy tells us on Facebook, people should be allowed to smoke in the office of the tobacco, cigarette, and cigar company execs, and no place else. You know, some people did mention places, some people did answer the questions, but the places were mostly limited to to private property. So they were basically saying your own house or your own car, and in some instances with the window up. For example, Emily writes us this on Facebook. You can smoke in your car. You can smoke outside in your yard. But as a mother of a child with asthma whose condition can flare up when walking through a cloud of smoke going into or out of buildings, my child's right to breathe clean air is more important. And really, that really kind of sums up most of the responses we got. Rick was one of the only divergents, saying, you still should be able to smoke in dive bars. I'm going to read his Facebook comment. Rick says, those of us content with being corralled into the filthy, scummy corners of the world should be allowed to be the filthy scumbags we are without being bothered or overrun by all you perfect people.
Oh, poor Rick. Well, that last one does sound a little like just an overall anti-smoking ban response. Did you get many of those?
Yes. I mean, overall, most people didn't want you smoking anywhere, but we did get some people that seemed to be kind of against the existing bans against smoking in Kansas City and on this particular one in housing, in public housing. For example, Ryan says that if we really wanted to clear the air, we should go ahead and ban cars too. And Lisa, she also asks, so when will fatty foods or sugar be banned in public housing or in your own house?
So, yeah, that's an that's kind of funny because, you know, people do make that comparison. But, of course, if someone eats fatty foods, that affects no one in the immediate surroundings. So
sure.
That's a little different, I guess. But there was what else, Allison? What else did people say? Some nuance?
Yeah.
To share.
Like I said, some people mentioned places. This really sparked a debate between smokers and non-smokers. Saw a lot of that. But the question actually brought up a lot about hookah bars, believe it or not. And people wanted to know, how could hookah bars in Kansas City get past the non-smoking ban when people in public housing are being told not to smoke? And we didn't want to leave people hanging, so we called the health department, and they explained that hookah bars don't serve food, and they don't serve liquor or beer. So they're not considered a restaurant or bar, and that's how they can kind of get through. And I was advised that if you're at a hookah bar selling food, to report them, because they shouldn't be doing that.
Well, that is something that I've wondered, so glad to know the answer to that.
And as an aside, we also had listeners raise the question of enforceability with this public housing smoking ban. And for instance, Amy says, you know, there are bans on college campuses, but they're ignored. Johnson County Community College is a smoke-free campus, yet it is covered in cigarette butts. There is no way to enforce the ban. And Roberta seemed to agree. She tells us on Facebook, does anyone really have the right to subject another to secondhand smoke? The question then becomes, what can be regulated and enforceable?
Hmm. So that issue of enforceability does kind of loom large here, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Allison, we've enjoyed having you here on Central Standard this week, as we always do. Thanks so much, and thanks for joining us on such a topical issue.
Thank you, Gina. And as always, if you're hearing this and you want to chime in, please tweet us your answer with the TellKCUR hashtag.
They said someday you'll find all who love are blind. Good dog.
That's all the time we have for today's conversation, what with all this smoke in our eyes and everything else. Thanks so much to all of our guests and contributors today. If you'd like to listen back to today's show or any previous conversations you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. You'll find our past shows archived there. Tomorrow, the movie critics visit our studios to review the latest films and to talk about the changing movie-going experience. Reclining chairs? Food service? You'll have a chance to weigh in, too. That's tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's Central Standard, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.